Women Podcast.
Hello, everybody. I'm Dr. Rebecca Hall. I am a historian and I am an attorney. I practiced law for 8 years in Oakland, California, working with low-income tenants. And then I went back to school after 8 years to get my PhD in history. And I study slavery and racialized gender and resistance. And I write and publish on those things in academic formats. And Lake, this graphic narrative, is the first time I've written and published something that was not academic. And yeah, it's been quite a ride. So
you wrote that as far back as you can remember, you've been searching for women warriors. Just thinking back to the young Dr. Hall, tell us something about your passions as a child. How did they shape you?
So ever since I was a little girl, I've been fascinated with women warriors, women who fought back, women who could protect themselves, women who could protect other women. And, you know, I grew up in the 70s and there was not a lot out there in popular culture. I think the best we had was like Charlie's Angels. And I've also always been drawn to the history of slave revolt and also maroon communities. Like even when I was like 11, I was like read this whole book on maroon communities. There were lots of books laying around my house when I was growing up and I was like an avid reader. So yeah, it kind of makes sense that I would go down this path. And there's been a lot of change, cultural change in the last, especially 2 decades, where there's much more positive portrayals of women as warriors. I don't know if you can see my Xena pillow back there.
Yes, I can. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not a popular culture scholar, but I really believe that show changed a lot. It was very different from other kind of narratives about women warriors.
And you used to be a lawyer.
Yes.
Can you explain the journey from law to writing?
Yeah, so I got my BA in history. I've always loved history. And when I graduated from college, I thought seriously about going on and getting a PhD in history. But I felt like I would be frustrated with being in academia and that it would be too separate from what's going on in the world and how I could actually help people in a more kind of hands-on way. And so, you know, ever since I was a kid, people were like, oh, you should be a lawyer. you know, and I was like, okay, well, let me do that. And so, you know, I went to Berkeley Law and then I focused on my passion in terms of law and legal representation, which was housing rights and suing slumlords. That's my favorite thing. So I actually missed that. So I did that for about 8 years and there were things that were really frustrating about it. I didn't think that I would be a lawyer and I would make like major systemic change and, you know, through that system. I didn't have that kind of naivete, but I thought that I could get at least sort of basic justice for my clients, you know, and I kept coming across these systemic things that made no sense in the context of legal doctrine, you know, where I would have plaintiffs and, you know, white women plaintiffs and black women plaintiffs, and they'd have the same facts and the same, damages, but the jury would give black women like half the money damages that white women got. And it was just a systemic thing. Like it was really a problem. I mean, people, lawyers can use these sort of jury educators that like come in and educate juries and educate lawyers on how to deal with juries. And the discourse was explicit. It was like, you need to tell your black women clients to act like white women. And, you know, and I was doing that. I was telling my black women clients, like, this is how you need to behave. You need to go on the stand and you need to be, show all your pain and be really vulnerable. And it was really hard. And if they even could do that, it still didn't work. And I was like, so what? What is this about? You know, and I dealt with my own, like, as a black woman attorney in the 90s, dealt with my own microaggressions. I don't really like the term microaggressions because they're usually not I mean, there's nothing micro about them. Like if I was ever working in a new courtroom, you know, the bailiff or would direct me to the defendant's chair. And I'm like, I'm not a defendant. I'm the attorney for the plaintiff. And, you know, just things like that. And so, you know, after giving it a really good go of 8 years, I felt like I knew from my own previous study of history that the deformations in the justice system were connected to the history of slavery. I just didn't know how. And so I decided, okay, I'm going to do the thing I originally wanted to do and go and get this PhD in history and try to figure it out. And I figured it out. It's very difficult. And, you know, I don't know, you know, I've been to the UK a few times. I was there for probably the longest was like for a month while I was doing dissertation research. I'm not so sure about the lived realities of Black people in the UK. I know a little bit about it, but, you know, here in the States, you know, the legacy of slavery on the ground in this country has really shaped everything about race relations. So one of the things that I learned, and I talk about it in Wake, is that so my focus was British America. You know, when you get a PhD in history, you got to focus on something like some discrete time period. And so I was studying, you know, the original laws that created chattel slavery, because I came into this study with the law background, you know, and that's why my focus was the 18th century, because, you know, in each British colony, these laws that instantiated chattel slavery, you know, at first it wasn't exactly clear what the status of Africans were who were brought here. Like maybe they're indentured servants, maybe they're indentured servants for life, but we don't really know. Like, what about the status of their children? And so the codification of these laws to create race-based chattel slavery, which by definition means you are enslaved for life. The slave status passes through the mother and your children are enslaved for life. And this is something that only Black people experience. So what was interesting is that our law is British common law. It still is. But certainly during the British colonial period, it was common law. And your status was, you know, it's patrilineal descent. You know, status passed through the father. That was just how it was. But with chattel slavery, the status passes through the mother. And it creates like two genders of women. You know, white women who give birth to heirs of property and Black women who give birth to property, right? And if you give birth to property, of course, you're subhuman. And all of this stuff about Black women are, you know, all the misogynoir, all the like Black women are not as sensate, you know, they don't experience suffering the way white women do. I mean, all of that just, you know, goes back to that time period and this specific construction of racialized gender that we're still dealing with. In my book, Wake, I actually quote Thomas Jefferson, which is, you know, a characteristic statement by him, you know, that talks about Black people in a way that, you know, that elucidates this point. So I remember talking with, I'm very active on Twitter. It's the only social media I do. It's like where all the authors are. So, you know, and you know, I don't know if you heard about the Ahmaud Arbery case over in the UK.
We did, yes.
Yes, yes. So, you know, these white men were, you know, basically chasing down this Black man and then killed him. You know, and people, Black and white, were like, I don't understand. Like, how could people see him as a threat when he was running away? This makes no sense. And I'm like, no, it makes perfect sense because the racial geography of slavery is still present, you know, violently present in the United States. So where Black people go, where they are, you know, it geographically, how they're behaving in certain places, you know, goes back to this racist geography. I mean, and the slave patrol, right? And so where it was white people's job, all white people's job to keep enslaved people in control. And we've had no reconciliation process. This stuff is not taught in school. So we haven't gotten at all to the other side of this. It's still very present. Yeah.
You know, you said we haven't gotten to the other side of it.
Mm-hmm.
You've had a Black president, for example. Will we ever get to the other side of it, in your view?
Not by having a Black president. It makes no difference that we have now a Black woman vice president, or we had a Black president. That's not how change happens. Social change, you know, is very much a bottom up thing. And, you know, you have, you know, President Obama, and, you know, I voted for him. I was excited, you know, but he's, you know, he's just another neoliberal. You know, he's sending drones to bomb people. He appoints, like, you know, really horrific people like Larry Summers. This is like head of economics who thinks that more toxic waste should be dumped in Africa. And, you know, I mean, it's just, this system is fundamentally messed up, and it's not going to be fixed by like putting some Black person in some position of power. That's not how change is going to happen. What's interesting though about the Obama presidency is that it certainly riled up a lot of white racists. And so they felt like it was a huge systematic change and very threatening. This is something that happens regularly in U.S. history, where you get something, some perceived advancement of Black people, and then you get like a backlash, or a white lash is really, and you know, you get this very violent reaction, really rooted in this like just fascist like replacement theories, like, you know, they're there to replace us. Mitch McConnell, just a couple days ago, who, what is he, the Senate minority leader, when they were talking about voter suppression, I mean, he literally said, I love when they say the quiet parts out loud. He literally just said that African-Americans vote as much as Americans. like, okay. So even though, you know, change wouldn't and didn't and couldn't happen through having a Black president or a Black vice president, it definitely caused this white lash. We are really going to a very, very dark place. I don't, you know, it's hard being a historian these days, you know, because I literally would give American democracy between 1 year and 3 years. And then I think it's over. And you know, people keep talking about, like, is there going to be another civil war in the United States? And what is that going to look like? And, you know, and one of the things that's really kind of, you know, I don't know if it's unique to the United States, but, you know, each, there's this idea that there's like red states, you know, conservative states, and blue states that are progressive states. And that's actually not true. Like every state, even if a state overall votes blue, there's like, you know, you take a place like Seattle, a very progressive city, and then the entire countryside is very reactionary. And so, you know, the violence that can happen just between people in a country where people have, what, 400 million guns? I don't know if you followed the horrible Kyle Rittenhouse case. Unreal. And this is the thing. It's like, that was an affirmation that this is okay. You know, this is okay. And it's like, if this is okay, we are in big trouble. Sorry, I went to this really dark place.
No, thank you. I mean, yeah, we can't imagine really here. But I'm really interested in that. You know, you said that you were looking for the erased, the unspoken blank spaces, and that suggests quite a difficult research process. So can you just talk us through the sort of the key, you know, what was your research process? What did you
have to do? Right. I think first, to frame this issue, I think it's important to understand that it's not as simple as women weren't in the documents, and so therefore, you know, the primary sources, and therefore their agency was erased. It's much more complicated than that. It has a lot to do with the way history is done. You know, history is written always in a social and political context. It's not written from the ether, right? And the way the history of slavery and slave resistance was taught in the United States for the longest time was that slavery was a benign institution, and it was a civilizing force, and it was a good thing. And there was absolutely no resistance to slavery in the United States because it was a good thing. And that was literally how it was taught, you know, until you know, the civil rights movement in the 60s, and you start getting, you know, some African-American scholars and some more progressive white scholars, et cetera, researching, and they're like, actually, there were hundreds of slave revolts in the United States. But at the same time they were doing that active recovery, it was in the social and political context in the United States of this war on poverty. And, you know, what is the issue with Black people? Like, Black people are poor and disenfranchised because of systemic racism. And, you know, the powers that be, the government, the Senate, were like, oh, no, no, that's not it. There's no systemic racism. The reason why Black people are not doing well is because they live in a culture of poverty caused by dysfunctional gender roles that they inherited from slavery. So they have these matriarchal Black women, which I still don't understand how you get matriarchal women from slavery, but whatever, who emasculate their men. And so they need to fix their gender roles and then things will be good. And so people responded to that by being saying like, no, our gender roles are correct. You know, and so you get all of this research on slave revolts where they'll say things like, well, of course, women didn't participate in this revolt. You know, there's a whole book about one revolt. Women didn't participate in this revolt because they wouldn't have undermined their men in that way. Right. You know, it, you know, politically, you've got the Black Panther Party and this idea that women should, you know, walk 10 steps behind their man. And, you know, Stokely Carmichael was asked, you know, what is the position of the Black woman in the movement? And he says prone. Right. So this is the whole context in which slave revolt is being reclaimed. And then you get the beginning of feminist historians. You know, now we're talking 80s, 90s. And their response to this was, well, if it's true that women weren't involved in slave revolt, they were involved in all these other kinds of resistance that were just as effective, if not more so, very powerful. We're going to recover this. You know, these individual acts of arson or poisoning their masters or breaking tools or, you know, this kind of weapons of the week. That was a very big thing in the 80s and 90s. And yes, those that resistance must be reclaimed and held up. It's very important. So when I entered into the academy, you know, and I started studying slavery, as I explained, I learned really quickly that it was a really bad mental health strategy for me to study slavery and not study slave resistance. So that's where I went. And, you know, when you get a PhD in history, you got to write something new. You can't just like write the same thing other people did. It's like, you're like, what am I adding? How am I contributing to the historiography of slave revolt? And this constant statement about women didn't do this was just kind of fascinating to me. I was like, what is that about? You know, and then what I just described to you about the social and political context, you know, that's what I learned. But so what happened, though, is that it continued to deform the historical research. So perfect example of this, in the 90s, these historians who had been studying the Atlantic slave trade, you know, all individually in their, you know, and then you've got the internet. And so they're like, let's create a database, all our research, we're going to put it in one database. And, you know, they created a database of 36,000 slave ship voyages. And that's actually online on the internet. It's called the Atlantic Slave Trade Database. Anyone can access it or use it. And, you know, these are quantitative historians. So what quantitative historians do is they build databases and then query them, right? And one of the first things they asked was, how many revolts were there on slave ships? And they found that there was a revolt on 1 in 10 ships. That actually shocked everybody because everyone thought that was a rare occurrence because it's extremely difficult. And also, frankly, 99% of the time, it's an act of suicide. So no one was expecting that many recorded, documented cases of revolt on slave ships. And so these quantitative historians said, okay, so let's compare the ships that had revolts and the ships that didn't have revolts and see what the difference was. And the only difference they could find was that the more women on the ship, the more likely to be a revolt. And they immediately dismissed their own findings and said, we know that women did not participate in this type of revolt. Just backing up a second, revolt, the thing that seemed to be the most difficult for historians to accept that women could participate in specifically, it was like organized violent acts of uprising, right? That was the part that just couldn't be like, no, you know, just no. And so when I was doing my research, I came to the UK and I spent a lot of time. I understood, you know, part of this is my law background, but that the slave trade was, you know, it was big business. You know, a lot of people have this idea that it was something that happened, I don't know, on the down low or, you know, some kind of anachronistic idea. It was huge business, you know, for England and for the UK. And, you know, the slave trade occurred over a 400-year period, but over 80% of the trade happened basically in the 18th century when the UK ran it, you know? So the way, you know, this is taught in the UK is that it's not taught. And instead the focus is on, oh, England was instrumental in the abolition of slavery. And that's all they talk about, right? But this was a huge part of the economy. And as such, it was highly regulated. You know, there were laws that regulated how slave ships were supposed to operate. There were regulations, there was insurance, et cetera. And one of the way that the ships were regulated to operate was that once a slave ship left the coast, like when the slave ship was on the coast of Africa, everybody was below deck and chained. When the ship left the coast of Africa, the women were unchained and brought on deck. And that's where the weapons were. And they had mobility. And that is why there were more revolts on ships that had women. And me, as a qualitative historian, where I was reading hundreds of slave ship logs, captain's logs, and I mean, the women are everywhere in them. And the captain's logs had to be kept so meticulously because these slave ships were insured. And this is another part of this is that, you know, like Lloyd's of London, for example, got its start insuring the slave trade. It was a very profitable business. And one of the things that they provide insurance against was something that was called the insurrection of cargo. Just that sentence is like, I don't know how to deal with it. But anyway, so there were insurance provisions. And so slave ship captains had to document when there was a revolt so that the owners of the ships could get reimbursed for that, right? And so when I was in the UK, I tried to get access to Lloyd's of London's archive and oh no, they like they would not give me access. So I think that all of this kind of goes to the question of what the research process is, what the obstacles are. You know, they're everything from like the historiography. Historiography is like methodology of history or, you know, how history has been written. So the whole historiography of slavery and slave resistance and revolt, access to the archives and dealing with obstacles, like racist obstacles to, you know, like we're not letting you in here, or just a lot of ignorance by archivists. You know, like I remember I was at the House of Lords records office and I'm like, I need to look at your documents related to slavery in the 1700s. And they're like, we don't have that. We only have documents about abolition, you know, in the early 1800s. I'm like, no, yeah, that's not true. Could you please look, you know? And there was a bunch of pushback, but they did finally. And then they came back with carts and carts and carts of documents. And this is where I've uncovered all of the stuff about the regulation of the trade.
You've talked a lot about what was really challenging about it. For you, what was the most rewarding aspect? You know, what piece did you sort of do a dance around the living room and think, you know, fantastic.
Yeah, so when I talked to my dissertation advisor, and I said, I want to write my dissertation on women involved in slave revolts or and women-led slave revolts. Her response to me was, I'm sure that happened, but you'll never find the documents. And like for me, that's like waving a red flag in front of a bull. You're like, oh, you think I'm not going to find them? And I think one of the most exciting things was when I found the trial records for the revolt that happened in New York City when it was a colony of England in 1712. And in the court records, there are lots of women involved in it. And I was so shocked that previous historians had just not looked at those. I mean, they're just in the municipal archives with, you know, it's like they're right there. And because the whole, you know, this myopic view that women were involved in that, nobody took the time to look. And so that was really exciting, you know, to find those core documents. Yeah.
Brilliant. So there might be people sort of similar to you really want to go back and research their own past. So mm-hmm. what advice would you give to somebody who wants to reclaim their narrative, who wants to do research right. and go back?
It's funny. You would think that historians would be good at that. That's a whole other thing. genealogy is a whole other thing, you know, mm-hmm. and I actually needed to do genealogical research for the first time when I was writing this graphic novel, which I wrote it, you know, almost 20 years after my dissertation. But I wanted to include my grandmother in the story, and I needed to find information about her. And I was doing sort of genealogy for the first time. Normally what happens is historians go into archives and, you know, there'll be like one historian and like 50 people who are researching their family history. And what's really frustrating for African-Americans, for Black people, is that it's very difficult to research our family history, you know, to go back more than the 1870 census, you know, before that, good luck, you know, it's very difficult. So I don't have advice for people who want to research their own family history. I feel like there are people, though, there are genealogists who specialize in that probably have much better skill set of how to navigate the issue of enslavement and the erasure of people's family and ancestral narratives. I mean, for me, what was kind of unique is that my paternal grandparents were born enslaved. And it's unique because I'm 59, but there was a huge generation skip in my family, right? And so I had all these stories from my father about his parents, particularly his mother. You know, he had actually published an autobiography. There was a bunch of stuff about it. And I was researching for the graphic novel. I, you know, found my grandmother's obituary. You know, I found, you know, exactly where she lived. I found a whole bunch of stuff about her that I included into the graphic narrative. I've never met anybody else alive today whose grandparents were born enslaved. My grandmother was born in 1860 on a plantation in Virginia. And my grandfather was born also in 1860 in a plantation in Tennessee. So, you know, and slavery didn't end till 1865 with the passage of the 13th Amendment. So they were children.
My parents came here straight from Nigeria. So it's not an experience that I have,
right.
You know, that sort of background. I don't know what that feels like. I mean, because that's a difficult experience. You don't even have your original name. You probably don't know which part of Africa they came from.
Nothing. In fact, my last name, Hall, is the name of the plantation owner of my paternal grandparent and great-grandparent, you know. And a lot of African-Americans are like, I'm getting rid of that. I'll change that name, you know, but I'm a historian. It's like, that's my name. And so I claim it and, you know, but yeah, it's very difficult. And I think that's another reason why it's so important to reclaim and teach resistance to slavery, because this history of slavery in the United States is extremely brutal and difficult. And a lot of times people are like, we don't want to study this anymore. This is just depressing. We don't want to, you know, but the thing is that, and I try to do this in my book, the resilience of African-Americans is just astounding. And the constant resistance and revolt that was instrumental in ending the institution of slavery is something to be so proud of, you know? And so I want people to feel proud about their ancestors and their background. At the same time, I don't want to negate the fact that it's very frustrating to not know really basic things. I would love to know what part of Africa, you know, I actually did this DNA test because my second book I'm currently working on, I'm trying to do some more family stuff. And I've never done that before because I don't like the idea of giving my DNA to a corporation, but I just said, like, bought the bullet and did it, you know, and the science isn't advanced enough to tell you. I mean, all they could do was say, your people are from West Africa, you know, you know, because enslaved people came from West and West Central Africa. So, yeah.
So actually here, well, and, you know, as you said, and in the States, that people do say, oh, not another story about slavery. Oh, mm-hmm. no, not another story about Black pain and Black trauma. Mm-hmm. So how would you answer someone who said something like that?
Right. So I'm all for Black joy. You know, let's do it. Let's, you know, find it. Let's uplift it. I, you know, I'm not against Black joy, obviously. But I feel like a crucial underpinning of the Black experience in the United States is this resilience and resistance. I'm not interested in studying and researching the endless horrors of slavery. My focus is on how we fought back and how the way we fought back impacted and created change, systemic change. To me, that's joyful and necessary. It's like a necessary foundation that you stand on. You know, I remember reading, talking to somebody who was like, you know, who's, you know, came from a family of Holocaust survivors. And, you know, there's always this thing like, when do I first tell my children about this horrible history that our family experienced? Should I do it when they're five? Should I do it when they're eight? Like, should I not do it at all? Should I let them do it in school? You know, it's a struggle. And it's similar when you're talking about your ancestors being enslaved. And I think that it's so important to say, when you're doing that, at the same time, you're saying, and we fought all the way. We fought and fought and fought, and we ended this institution. So that's one thing. And the other thing is you need to understand race relations in the United States, and you're not going to be able to understand it by just focusing on joy. You know, you need to understand these legacies and, you know, living in the wake of slavery and how it shapes our life so that we can, first of all, understand the world around you. I mean, I can't, for me, the worst thing is to be living in an experience and not understand what's going on or why, but also to figure out what we need, like how can we, what needs to change? What do we need to get rid of? What do we need to focus on? You know, is it a Black president? You know, or is it the abolition of the police? You know, it's like, you have to understand, it's just, I just feel like we're not going to get anywhere if we don't understand our history. To me, that's just basic.
You talk a lot about the American experience. Mm-hmm. There are going to be people in the UK who say, well, it's not just another story about America, is it? How is it relevant to me?
Right. This to me is a fascinating thing because there's another side of it, which is that there are people in, you know, Black Americans who keep getting frustrated by, for example, Afro-Brit actors coming and playing Harriet Tubman, or, you know, I'm not one of those people. I don't care. But, you know, there's this whole, like, you know, American descendants of slavery, like we have a different experience and these Afro-Brits are, I don't, this, all this, this whole scarcity thing, I'm just like, please, you know, that's not how we're going to move forward. But I think for people who, you know, who are Black and British, I mean, I can't personally speak to that, but I think, you know, history is being reclaimed that shows, you know, a Black presence in the UK over a thousand years. I mean, it's, you know, people are beginning to start to reclaim the history of Afro-Brits. But I also think that there's not this huge difference, right? Because the slave trade and slavery was a British institution. And let's stop being in denial about that. I mean, the Americans took it and run with it in terms of it being like, you know, a slave society in this country, you know, unlike in the UK. But it's sort, I feel like it's all a piece, you know? And I think there's also a lot of Afro-Brits in the UK who came from the Caribbean. So they have that experience as well. I think like your experience of, you know, your descendants of Nigerians, that's a very different history. You don't have a history of enslavement. like you were saying, you have, you know, you're able to trace your family history and know your actual name and all of those things. But we all live on an anti-Black planet. And so we have a lot of shared experience. And I don't know how, like, you know, when you talk about how, like, we learn about Martin Luther King, there's this way in which the resistance, you know, people are, I mean, I've talked to other people of color and they're like, Black people's resistance has held up. Like the civil rights movement, you guys did all this stuff and blah, blah, blah. But, you know, my background as a Filipino or my background as a whatever, that's not, and it's like, okay, but you need to understand that, you know, mainstream society is putting a lot of energy into pacifying this history. So all we have now is Martin Luther King, and he had a dream. And people don't even know the rest of that sentence, much less have they listened to the entire speech, which is beautiful and brilliant, you know? And you have like right-wing, ultra-right-wing people, you know, wielding this, I have a dream. It's just like, I have a being, I have a cream, I have a team. It just has no meaning, you know? And also people are like, we need a leader like Martin Luther King, then we could, it's like, no, that's the, you know, like the Montgomery bus boycott, that was organized by lots of Black women on the ground. And then they brought Martin Luther King in to be a spokesperson for it. Or take Rosa Parks, you know, she was just tired and just had to sit down, you know, and she was an activist. She'd been an activist her entire life. That it, you know, and so there's this way in which Black, the things that people hold up of like, you know, Black Americans get all the airwaves, you know, about their pain and also about their struggles and fight. And I just want to put out there that no one's taught it in school. I'm kind of strange because I've taught everything from law school to graduate school to college to high school. And I can tell you, this history is not taught. All people learn in high school is that there was slavery and there was a civil war and Lincoln ended slavery with the Emancipation Proclamation. And that's it, you know. And, you know, maybe they'll learn that Martin Luther King had a dream and Rosa Parks was tired. And that's what people are taught.
Gosh. What do you want people to take from reading the text, whoever they be?
Yeah, that's an interesting question because I think it lands differently depending on your background. Like if you're a descendant of enslaved people, it's going to land a certain way. If you're Black in general, it's also going to land a certain way. I think it'll land differently for others. But one of the things that that has shocked me since this book came out is how it has resonated with so many people. You know, I even saw like YouTube channels of young white guys who review comic books, you know, like talking about Wake and being like, oh my God, I never was taught this history. And now I'm really angry. And so it's kind of shocking to me how it's just kind of got out there and kind of just landed with people. And, you know, I think one of the things that people have taken away from it is that there is this history. We need to know it. It's not taught. That's not acceptable. We have to do something about that. But I think what I really want people to take away from it, especially people whose ancestry, you know, are, you know, enslaved people, or anyone who experiences anti-Black racism, because I mean, I think these things really feed together. I want people to understand how brutally racialized this country is, and how its origin is in indigenous genocide and slavery. And the things that we're dealing with today are connected to that. I want people to take that away. And I also want people, and you know, I talk about this in the last chapter, I want people to be able to come to terms with kind of the trauma of the history and not run from it or feel like it has to be denied or ignored, but to instead to bring it and internalize it and integrate it into who we are and get power from that. You know, there's power from that, from honoring our ancestors and honoring the dead. You know, I mean, that's another way that the word wake, you know, the word wake has multiple valences, like a wake, like is in a funeral where you honor the dead. And, you know, I say that our memories must be longer than our lifespans, you know, it's, and so it's that kind of healing and that kind of knowledge about why we're where we are that I want people to take away from the book. And I also want women, people to take away from the book that women are badass and that, you know, we fight, you know, we've always fought.
Right. So could you tell us something about any current or future projects?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the whole thing was just crazy. I don't know if you know the backstory for this book, but it was like I had been fired from teaching at this high school. It was like the fourth time I'd been fired. Like I was specifically recruited to this school to help to teach race and to help these refugee teens who are in a very racially hostile environment. They're like, we need somebody like you, Dr. Hall, to go in there and protect them and shake things up and, you know, deal with the fact that all the teachers are white and blah, 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 all this stuff. So I do that and then I do what they say. And then basically I get fired for doing it. And at that point I was just like, you know what? I'm done. I'm done trying to be in the education system. It is fundamentally messed up and racist and there's nothing I can do in the system. And so then I was like, well, what can I do outside the system? And I was like, one of the things that was most frustrating for me is that I had done all this work, all this research, and wrote this dissertation and published articles about women in slave revolts. And it was just stuck behind, like, you know, the academic curtain, you know, I probably like 8 people have like read it, you know, and I wanted to get this information out there. And so I decided I wanted to do it in a graphic narrative, not that I had any experience doing anything like that. I have only written academic stuff. But I've been a fan of graphic novels. I think they're really powerful. I didn't even know why they were powerful. So I had to learn a lot about like, oh, that's why. This is the methodology. These are the things you can do in a graphic narrative that you can't do in anything else. Like a big part of my project is putting the past up against the present constantly. And, you know, the graphic narrative is the perfect medium for that. And there are all kinds of other things about the graphic narrative that lets you do things that you can't do otherwise, like in prose or in film or in poetry. And, you know, I found Hugo. I loved his art. We had this little Kickstarter. I don't even know. I wasn't even thinking it through. I was like, I was unemployed. You know, I didn't have any health insurance because this is the United States and it's crazy. And then I was like, well, let's do this project. And like, I thought I would self-publish or maybe a tiny press would be interested. I just thought this isn't something that most people would resonate with. So then, you know, press started about the Kickstarter and then I got contacted by an agent, you know, the person who discovered Marjane Satrapi's Persepolis, you know, and, you know, taught me how to write a book proposal for like, you know, commercial press. And it ended up going to like a literary auction, which I didn't even know was a thing. And anyway, so Simon & Schuster bought it. I mean, I chose Simon & Schuster of the ones and they also said, we want to option your next book because I wanted to write on Reconstruction, the period, like Civil War and Reconstruction. So that's the book I'm working on now. I've been working on it. Actually, I was almost all through the pandemic in New York City working at the Schomburg Center and the New York Public Library researching. And the tentative title now is called Taking Freedom, Black Women and Emancipation. And in it, I'm trying to intervene into this pacification narrative about Lincoln freed the slaves because, you know, during the Civil War, you know, at this point, there are like 4 million enslaved people in the South. You know, during the Civil War, 500,000 enslaved people walked off of plantations. They're like, bye, you know? I mean, that's the largest slave revolt. Well, you could call it a slave revolt. You could call it a general strike. I don't know. But it was really, it had a big impact, you know? And so I'm really interested in very bottom grassroots resistance. That's my thing and my passion. So the things that I found are during the Civil War itself, you see enslaved women, enslaved people generally, you know, really acting up. They know things are changing. So you'll see like in newspaper articles or diaries or letters, you know, like the slave owning women, like they write them these letters. And that's like one of my big sources of these like letters of these slave owning women. I call them my slave holding Karens. You know, they're like writing about like, oh my God, I went out and the women killed all the livestock and had a huge feast. Or I went and I tried to get them to do some work, but they had built a gallows in front of the house. And anytime I asked to do something, they would just point at the gallows. You know, so just like crazy stories like that. And, you know, also looking through the Reconstruction period, which is so important in U.S. history, because it's really kind of was like a failed revolution. Like if it had gone the way it should have gone, a lot of these issues of anti-Black racism and issues that Black people face in America would not be like this. But it was interrupted, cut short, and devastated. But during this period of Reconstruction, there was so much going on. Like, for example, in the very first, like, I don't know, like 1866, like the very beginning, before radical Reconstruction took over, there were all these Black codes that were basically re-enslaving Black people by coming up, working around the 13th Amendment by like, we're going to claim that you're a vagrant if you're not working for a white person. And the 13th Amendment has an exception, right? Like for people convicted of a crime, there's still slavery. So, you know, so there are these women who got arrested for vagrancy and they're like in the jail. And then there's this like group of other women who came and broke them out and they all like disappeared, you know? I mean, there are endless stories like this and it's just fascinating to me. And it makes me happy. You know? I mean, and so I'm writing about that. I'm writing about how enslaved people, women in particular, took their own freedom, and also trying to clarify things like, okay, the Emancipation Proclamation, that's a document people should just look at because it didn't free a single slave. It says right in the first three sentences, it says, you know, that any slave in a state in a state that's in rebellion against the United States is free, you know? And so there were slave states in the Union and it didn't apply to them, you know? So enslaved people in Delaware or whatever, Maryland, slavery didn't end for them until the 13th Amendment passed in December of 1865. You know, the Emancipation Proclamation, it applied to a place that the Union had absolutely no jurisdiction, right? It's like, and it was actually part of a series of what's called confiscation acts. So if you're like at war with somebody, one of the things you can do is try to undermine their ability by like taking their war material and undermining their economy and things like that. And it was part of that process. It, you know, it wasn't really, but then Black people made it about freedom. They changed the discourse and made it about freedom. So that's what I'm working on.
Is it another graphic novel?
Absolutely. I'm completely committed to this now. It was such a steep learning curve to figure out how to do this. And then seeing how powerful it is and how it resonates with people and makes things accessible without dumbing anything down, keeping its complexity. I think people are beginning to understand that the graphic narrative format needs to be used more because it speaks to people in a way that other things don't. And, you know, in Wake, you know, if you've read Wake, there's some very complicated stuff in there, you know, so like, you know, old British statutory laws and, you know, I mean, it's not dumbed down, but it still becomes more accessible. And so, yes, absolutely. You know, what I'm working on too is like creating kind of an explicit feminist methodology, you know, like a Black feminist methodology of using the graphic narrative. I keep saying narrative because I don't like the term novel, because novel implies fiction. But graphic novel is the term of art, and I don't think I'm going to be able to change it personally. But you know, like there's this whole relationship. This is just an example. There's this whole relationship in the graphic narrative between the panel, you know, what's drawn, and the gutter, which is the space between panels, right? And you have to think that through very carefully because, I mean, if you want to see every frame, you go to a movie, right? But with a graphic narrative, you're very carefully constructing what you're showing, what's not being shown, the relationship between the panels and this gutter space. And this gutter space, there are whole books written on this gutter space. It's kind of crazy, you know, but it's the person reading it gets sort of becomes almost a co-creator of the narrative, because they are tying the pieces together between the panel and the gutter. So people's readings of it, you know, it's a very different reading experience. And also in terms of like recovering the narrative of Black women, so many of the sources are very fragmentary. And so the fragmentary nature of the graphic narrative is incredibly generative to be able to sort of reclaim these stories in a way that hit, you know, that does honor to the people whose stories we're reclaiming, you know, and that impacts people today.
So at the beginning, we started with the young Dr. Hall. And so now I'm going to move you forward into the future when you're 80 or 90. Where would you like to see yourself?
I want to be dead before there's a trillionaire. You know, I just don't want. Oh, God, no. I have many books in me, and there's so much that needs to be told. So I see myself continuing to write books. And also, this book has exploded in all these really weird ways. Like, so, for example, there is an audio drama being made. You know, I didn't even know what an audio drama was. And, you know, and there's like this television writer who wrote the script, and it's like really powerful. And, you know, this company's hiring like A-list actors. I mean, so there's this whole thing over here. And then there's like a film agent. And then there's like other country. I mean, it was published in the UK simultaneously, right, with Penguin Random House. But now it's coming out in German, French, Spanish, Turkish, Japanese, and Korean. I'm like, what? You know, this morning I was looking at the cover in German. Fortunately, my wife is German, you know, and she was reading it. And she's like, no, that makes sense as a translation for this book. They don't have a word like wake in all these other languages. It's hard to find a word to replace that. And, you know, it keeps winning awards. Like, I just got nominated for the NAACP Image Award and another award I'm not allowed to talk about yet because they haven't announced it. And so it's also kind of blowing up in all these weird ways. So I don't know what, I have no idea what this is. This is not any part of my career that I expected or trained for or whatever. Like, I don't, you know, I just had to hire an assistant because my life is completely unmanageable. And it's like a fire hose of stuff coming at me all the time. And I'm traveling constantly to talk about wake. Like, I'm going to Norway in like 10 days for a literary festival there. And then I'm, you know, going to be traveling from New York down to New Orleans for like 6 weeks. You know, all this is happening while I'm trying to write my current book, you know, it's like, and it's hard. People are like, well, just stop working on that book and focus all on this. And it's like, that makes sense. That's logical. But it's also a creative process. It's almost like someone, like you're 4.5 months pregnant, and then someone's like, stop that for a year, you know, and then finish that other 4.5 months, you know. So, yeah, I'm having trouble managing my life. If anyone has any ideas, I'm open to them.
So my last question is, is there anything that I haven't asked you that you'd like to say to finish off?
People in the UK need to know about the slave trade and England's role in it, which was extremely profound. And that a lot of the wealth that exists in the UK was developed through the slave trade. So the fact that slavery didn't exist on the ground in the UK, basically, right? There were a couple exceptions. Still, slavery and the slave trade is central to the history of the UK and all its endless colonies, you know, like the sun never sets on the British Empire. Well, fortunately, I think the sun has set. There's no more slaves in the sun, but all this stuff is still there. You know, it's still there in former colonies. And I have a ongoing beef with Lloyd's of London. I guess I want people to know about that. It's not like they were the only ones, but they that's literally how they got their start was in ensuring the slave trade. And you know, they have been very aggressively not letting anyone who studies slavery into their archives, and it's a private corporation, so they can do what they want. you know, it's not like a public library or municipal archives. They can say who comes and who doesn't. And there are plenty of historians who come and study all kinds of things there, but not if you're studying slavery. And then after the murder of George Floyd, you know, we have this idea that we're having a racial reckoning. You know, I think it's over. You know, these racial reckonings, they last about 11 months and then everybody moves on. But they were like coming out about, yes, we have this past, we have this connection with slavery, we need to confront it. And that was great. But it was kind of being dealt with like almost like a PR spin. Like the way we're going to deal with it is we're going to have more diversity in our staff. But I'm so proud of the UK in this uprising, how people just came up and just was like, no, no, throwing slave trader statues into the harbor. Yes, it's like they couldn't just PR spin it because you people wouldn't let them. And now they have an archivist who is dealing with their records of slavery, and I'm in contact with her. It's still fraught and problematic, but I don't know. I want you folks to just be proud. I've just been in awe of how Afro-Brits and other British people have just fought back and keep fighting back. Yeah, it's an inspiration.
Why were Lloyds not letting people in?
Because they don't want to be sued. They don't want to be sued for reparations, which is not, I was not interested in that at all. I don't care. I don't want to sue them. I want their documents about payouts for the insurrection of cargo so I can track down more stories of revolts. That's all I want. But they're concerned about their image, like any corporation, any financial institution, and they're concerned about liability. So that's why. And I want stories. I'm interested in stories. I want to reclaim stories. That's my passion.
Thank you very much.
And right. You're welcome. Be take nice. Care.
Okay, yeah. Take care.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Women Podcast. Women Podcast.